Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is the Mark Boris Podcast.
Good morning. Fucking awesome morning looking down here at William Street. We're here with Nick and Grant. And we're going to cover off a few interesting things. A few interesting things this morning. I have to say that we're doing on Tuesday morning because I've got to go to Darwin tomorrow, so we had to bring it forward, unfortunately, or fortunately. Grant Williams, mate of mine, mate of all of ours, otherwise known as Grunt. I don't know why the hell he's got the name Grunt. It sounds a bit awful, but Grant Williams, he's the executive producer, or EP, what they call as EP at Channel 9 for the Current Affair, has been there for a million years, ex-copper. I got to declare early that he's mates with a lot of my cop mates, and so we got sort of close relationship here. What I want to talk to Grant today about is a few interesting things. First and foremost, about I want to talk to him about his early career as a cop, how that assisted him to become good at what he does as the executive producer of the Current Affair, which is, you know, the only surviving Current Affair in the country at the moment. I want to get some few war stories from him. I'm really interested about the Packer-Gingell fight, especially now Gingell's not the CEO anymore. And then I want to talk to him about something interesting that he was just telling me then as we're standing here, that there's now a demand in corporate Australia that's sort of been tapping at his door, asking him to help them with sort of, you know, sort of groundwork, so, getting intelligence on the ground about things that are going within their organisations. And one of the things I know, my business, is that we get removed from that sort of stuff at my level, at what let's call it the C level, and C stands for chief something or other, doesn't stand for something, some other word. At the C level, we get removed from what's going on in the business and we need intelligence on the ground. And Grant, with his great investigative background and police background, et cetera, is sort of getting tapped on the shoulder for these sorts of stuff. So I'm curious to hear about that. So welcome, Grunner.
G'day, Mark. How are you, mate?
Good, mate. How does this feel to be on the other side of the microphone? Because you're normally sort of conducting the orchestra here. You're normally the EP, the executive producer. You've normally got people shitting their pants about being interviewed by someone at a Current Affair like Tracy.
That's true. That's true. I'm actually shitting my pants as we speak because I'm worried that I'm going to be fired any moment for a start.
How good is this?
Yeah.
Grant Williams on the back foot. What do you reckon
you've
that for?
You've got me on the back foot already.
Yeah. So, mate, so. Just tell me about your background. So, start from the cops. Tell me how you all started off.
Well, very quickly, when I left school, I was actually, believe it or not, a trainee photographer at the Daily Telegraph. And so I always had a sort of a journalistic bent from when I left school. And as part of that, the actual reporters, the copy kids who were going to become reporters, they did their shorthand courses and whatnot. The photography kids in the Daily Telegraph photographic department, they had to go to tech and do your photography trade with the old view cameras, with the black cloth over the head, the whole thing. And I got down there and there were about five or six blokes from the police scientific squad in the class at tech. And I was getting $156 a week clear at the Daily Telegraph in those days. And I said to one of the scientific squad blokes at tech, I said, mate, could you bring me in some brochures for the coppers, some recruitment material? And the following week, the bloke brought one in and he said, mate, here's the pamphlet. I opened it up and it said you got $350 a week to go to the academy. I thought, hang on, I'm going to double my money overnight. So where do I sign? So bang, that's how I ended up in the coppers. I found my way into the old central lane, the old central police station. opposite Hoyt's up there in George Street. Half of the building was condemned. Half of the police there were under house arrest. It was a baptism of fire for a bloke who just turned 19. I was a skinny little bloke. I hadn't seen too many angry men in my day. And you grew up fast in that environment. And within 12 months of being in uniform, I was tapped on the shoulder to become a trainee detective there at Central Police Station.
And then of the cops, who's someone you remember being under, in other words, a mentor of yours?
Well, there's a bloke who was my workmate for many years at Central and then City of Sydney Detectives, a bloke called Luke Frudenstein, who these days is the...
Fruity.
Who's
not a bad boxer.
He's a good boxer.
Yeah,
a good boxer. And he and I used to work our proverbials off in that joint down there. We had some interesting coves who were in our cohort there at City of Sydney Detectives. We had blokes like Trevor Haken and Chuck Fowler, who you've probably heard of, blokes who spent a bit of time out the window here. Got on the Golden Mile. And look, it wasn't for the faint-hearted. You saw some amazing stuff. But I think it really, I look back on it and I think, thank heavens I ended up in the coppers, because it absolutely instructed my career. It turned me into the bloke I am today and gave me the capacity to deal with the situations and the management and the role that I have today.
So what do you reckon you learned, though, like skill-wise? So, like, how to cut through in terms of investigations? I mean, to be fearful?
I think becoming a detective at a young bloke, it set you up beautifully with a very finely tuned bullshit radar. And that's what's got me through life beautifully, I think. The bullshit radar is the most important thing that you can have. You can't bullshit a bullshitter, which is something I learnt later on as well. And essentially, being a young detective, interviewing people from all walks of life, whether it be a young armed robber, a 13-year-old Indigenous kid who's knocked a Commodore off, the Premier in Macquarie Street over some substantial fraud involving the government, it set me up with that range of experience, and also set me up with a range of dangerous situations and situations that you quite often couldn't believe you were there. So many things were surreal. Waiting for an armed robbery to unfold in front of you while I was at the surveillance unit, for example. Living in an apartment at Petersham, in a duplex at Petersham, with listening devices set up in the house next door, while the two blokes in there rack up their shotguns at night and load their weapons and then jump on their motorbikes and take off, having conversations about whether or not the dopey-looking bloke next door with the short hair, could he be a copper when you're living in the duplex next door? These sort of experiences, you can't... You just couldn't write about
them. And you can't learn them in the university.
You can't learn them.
No.
They're straight out of a movie. And, you know, back in those days, you had the old, you know, we're here in a state-of-the-art recording studio. Back in those days, you had these bloody great tape machines that you had to lug in there, and these big bags with the big tape, you know, on the spool, and you had to, that was what was recording the listening device in the crook's house. And you had to fart around at 3 a.m. changing the spool over and running the tape, you know, through the spool machine and listening to these clowns. And these were the guys that were involved in shooting a security guard in the head in the Westpac in George Street at Martin Place.
I remember that.
You know what I mean? And then a couple of days later, we go down there to check out their address. We got onto them. They were living with a girl called Cassandra Favell, who was a young blonde woman with a child, and her father was the Garbo killed in the Hilton bombing.
Oh, my God.
Right? And she bought this house at Petersham with the proceeds of the compensation from that, from the death of a father, and these two no-hoper armed robbers shack up with her and used it as a base. Now, unluckily for me, when I went down there and checked the address out, there was an LJ Hooker Petersham for lease sign in the duplex next door, so the old Sarge said, mate, you're in. Go and sign the lease. You're moving in there. So I had to move in there and mate, there weren't too many volunteers in the senior ranks to spend the nights there. So I think I slept on one of those old Kmart banana chairs for about 7 weeks, you know. So these are the sort of experiences that unfolded that sort of set you up as a young bloke where, as you proceed through life, nothing's a problem. You know, I've always been the sort of bloke that will... I'm no hero, I'm no tough guy, but I am always the bloke that's good in a crisis, and I am always the bloke that'll run into the fire, not run out. And that's always been part of my makeup. And And that's just set me up beautifully to plough through.
Grant, how did you get involved with ACCA? How did you get involved in Current Affairs or television? How did that come about?
Well, that's another interesting, very circuitous sort of route, but there's a very quick transition I can make from the cops. I met a bloke called Hal McElroy, who was a big TV producer at the time, and he was making a show called Water Rats on the Harbour involving the water police. And they had an office out on Goat Island. That's where they filmed the program. The studio was out there. And they were looking for a detective from the cops to become the police advisor on the show. And I put my hand up for it, went and spoke to him, went on leave without pay from the cops to do it because I thought this is a bit of a rort. I'll probably go and do it for 18 months and then come back to the cops. Got the approval from the commissioner, who was Peter Ryan at the time, the English bloke. Went off to Water Rats, did that on leave without pay for a while, working for Hal McElroy, and then thought, how good's this? How good's this TV caper? Colin Friels was the lead actor at the time. He got cancer. Steve Bisley was brought in as the lead actor. I thought to myself, this show mightn't be long for the world. I will decide what I'm going to do in terms of going back to the cops or not. So I resigned from the cops. I took a leap of faith. I went and worked. I went and did a full-time course at the Australian Film and Television and Radio School as a producer, which was then at Macquarie University. It's now over at Fox Studios. I by then had my first baby, had a kid who was only about 4 months old, so needed some income, was doing the full-time study, worked for the Maloney family at night in various pubs around Sydney to pay my bills.
It's old Cyril.
Yeah, and Kim, and worked for them. And then as part of my attachment, as part of my course at the film school, they sent you to Nine. I put my hand up for Nine to go there on an internship for 4 weeks. And the first 2 weeks, they put me with Reg Livermore at a show called Our House. And next thing I'm up at, this is the copper who's gone from, you know, living next, locking up armed robbers and God knows what. I'm up at Katoomba with Reg Livermore looking at his collection of French fabric, right? In his wardrobe, you know what I mean? And we're out and I actually...
Is that it?
And I actually did...
Is that what you want to tell
and
us
I
about?
Actually did, and I actually did one of the first ever stories that Jamie Jury did on TV about indoor plants, would you believe? And I'm thinking, well, I don't know if the French fabric, the indoor plants, I don't know if that's quite my bag. I went down to a Current Affair and I was age 30. I went down there for some work experience at ACCA and I just thought, I reckon I could bullshit my way into this joint. And so I just went my hardest, pretended I knew what I was doing. I was the oldest work experience kid they'd ever seen. and just went out and just had a go, interviewed blokes, went on the road with the camera crews, just did everything like I'd been doing it for months, pretended I knew what I was doing, and fudged my way through. And then eventually one of the senior blokes, this old character in the office called John Muldrew, he actually pulled the boss aside and just said, look, I've been keeping an eye on this young bloke, this work experience bloke. I think you should grab him. And what, unbeknownst to me, a few of the cameramen had also been to the boss and said, mate, this bloke, if he doesn't know what he's doing, he's putting on a fair show, pretending he does. And then next thing, they tapped me on the shoulder and they said, look, there's been a heap of redundancies here. We haven't got any money to hire you, but if you want to hang around, you can. So I worked for another 6 months for nothing and kept working in the pub at night. And ploughed on there, and then, you know, 9 or 10 years later, I was running the joint.
Did you work under Hurley?
Yeah, under Hurley back in those days. So he was the first bloke to hire me, Hurley, and, you know, Mike Munro and Ray Martin were the hosts back in those days, and I worked with Munro extensively. And a short time later, I was made Munro's producer.
Is this Hurley as scary as everyone thinks? Like, I mean, I know him, but
yeah.
I mean, he's, in terms of managing public relations and or stories that come in and out about your own characters and your own TV station.
Sure,
tell us a little bit about Hurley, David Hurley.
Well, David Hurley, he's quite a renaissance man. He's a bit of a legendary character in the Sydney media. He was actually one of Neville Rand's press secretaries back in the day, and he sort of he came through the old Telegraph and. He was just a bit of a character and found his way into Channel 9. He's always got a story, Hurls, and he's a tragic Tigers supporter. He's the sort of bloke that, you know, be ready for a long conversation. You know, you don't have a short one with Dave.
And if there's trouble, he used to be the go-to guy.
He was the go-to guy, you know, and to be fair, I won't kid myself. I've probably tried to model myself on him a little bit and consider myself, you know, if ever I've got 30 or 40% of the skills that that bloke does, I'll be traveling.
That's sort of
well.
Where I want to get to, Graham, because like a lot of people listening to this show always talk about mentorship. And I know you were for Hurley, and I know you probably have modelled yourself because he's such a powerful sort of guy with so much momentum, I mean, as an individual. How important is mentorship to you?
Mentorship is huge. You know, I've been a bloke who I've always run whatever I've done at Nine, I've always run it like the family business, and I treat it like it's my brand. I care about it immensely. I'm working on it 24 hours a day. I provide a lot of mentorship to the young kids. I worked at 2UE with John Laws for a couple of years, and a lot of the junior producers that I hired back in those days, I've brought through to Channel 9. And I'm proud to say that a few of those girls in particular are now some of the brightest stars at the network. And I'm so proud that I identified those kids straight out of uni and then have brought them through. There's another girl in Melbourne, for example, while I was working down at GTV at Bendigo Street, Richmond. There was a girl, a barmaid at the Bridge Hotel in Richmond, who was doing, who was at uni doing journalism. I identified her. I said, look, you're a gun. Get out of the pub. Get out of uni. Come and work for us. She's now one of the brightest stars on air at Channel 9 in Melbourne and reporting every night of the week on the 6 p.m. bulletin. So I've loved identifying the new talent and mentoring them all the way through. And always respecting and remembering the opportunity I was given, albeit at the age of 30, but by a bloke like Hurley who took a chance on me and said, yeah, this bloke might be a goer.
Well, it's interesting is you said you've always thought of the business as your own and your own brand. I mean, I'm always talking about when you're employing people that you've got to employ people who think like they're the proprietor. Mm. It seems to me there's a lot of people at Nine think that way about their role. I mean, I think Healy would think that way in terms of what he does in terms of programming.
Yep, no question.
Backwell also, he would think the same way. You think that way about Acker.
Yep.
I presume in the newsroom, is it Wicks?
Yeah, Darren Wick, Simon Hobbs in Sydney.
Would think that way as well. And of course, Gingell thinks that way.
That's right.
Well, thought that way because he's no longer there anymore.
Yep.
But I think the success of many organisations is a lot of times based on the fact that the people who are in the senior management roles think as a proprietor. Do you think that's an important role?
I think it's huge. And, you know, my wife obviously, you know, sometimes she just despairs at the hours we work in that place. You know, we'll be up at 4:30 and I'll be home at 9 o'clock at night, you know. And I'm now coming up to my 8th year as the national executive producer. And I always say to her, well, guess what? You know, we live over Manly Way. And I always say, well, you know, this poor bastard down at the chicken shop in Balgowla, he's there at 4 a.m. cooking chooks. And I see him when I drive past at night, he's still there at 9 o'clock pulling chooks off the rotisserie and probably having to turf them and turf out half the salads he's got in there. And he's trying to make a quid as well. You know what I mean? And if he can do it, I can do it. I'm running an iconic national TV show that's been around for 40 years. And as a custodian of that, I'm obliged to actually run it like it's my own business. And if I don't want to do that, I should get the hell out of it.
I think you should piss off. I agree with that. I mean, 100%. Yeah. And I just touched on it. I can't go past quickly asking you about the Packer Gingell punch-up or whatever that – we probably shouldn't be calling it a punch-up, but the scuffle.
The scuffle, yeah.
Can you
–
I mean, out of interest, I mean, what everybody wants to hear about it, I mean, but you're right there. I mean, you weren't there on the day, but you have a very close connection with both individuals. You know both individuals very well, particularly one of them.
Yep.
You guys covered it off. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, it's no secret that a lot of us at Nine absolutely, you know, have the greatest respect for David Gingell. And I think you addressed it, you were sort of hinting at it before. There's another good reason why I run or have run the business like it's my own business because of that bloke.
Because he lets you do it.
Because he lets you do it. Yeah. And he knows, and mate, he'll ring you and he'll kick you in the ass. And you know why you always run it like it's your own business as well with Gingell? Because he watches your product.
Mm.
He knows your product. And you can't fudge. He's not ringing you up saying, oh, mate, I watched A Current Affair 6 weeks ago and I thought it was pretty shit. He can tell you what was on last night down to each commercial break, right? But look, I think it was one of the more interesting episodes we've had at Nine with the video and the skills
of the video.
Well, look, the whole thing was, you know, people, you know, it's been well documented that paparazzi were hanging around at James's place with a view that they would try and get shots of Miranda Kerr returning to Sydney from the States with James. And what transpired was that there was a Channel 9 news truck, a Link truck, parked up the same side street innocently because the young bloke who was on call lived up there. He's a Bondi resident, right? So James automatically thinks, oh, hang on, they're all over it. Channel 9 sent a truck down here. They're trying to stake out the joint, trying to get Miranda. And Ginge knew nothing about it. No one at Nine knew anything about it.
I was with him before having breakfast.
Exactly. So he's in the surf. He jumps out. He gets these cranky calls from James saying, mate, what are you doing? Piss the truck off, kind of thing. And he had no idea. He had no idea what it was all about. So next thing it's on. So Ginge goes up and waits for him. Now, there was some paparazzi there, and they were waiting for Miranda Kerr, supposedly, to turn up. They didn't realise that this bloke in the tracksuit was David Ginge. They just saw him there. So they actually thought they had shots of a hobo attacking James Packer is the reality of it, you know, because he'd been on holidays and he had the big beard and everything and he was in his tracky dacks and whatever. Anyway, so cut a long story short, it ends up in a situation where these a huge number of still photos and video is made available by paparazzi. And this was on the Sunday afternoon. Of course, on the Monday morning, I land in the office and it's on for young and old. And I've got this paparazzi girl coming into my office and she's got all the stills and all the video.
Do you buy it from her? How's it work?
We could have.
You could have.
Right. They wanted Big Biscuit, obviously.
How much are you talking for?
Oh, you're talking $250,000 or thereabouts, Jesus. Right? Now, of course, we're talking about a public company here. And look, we went up and we had a meeting. You know, there were various. You know, we're obviously it was a bit of a crisis in the scope of the Nine Network. Let's be fair, but Ginge is the sort of bloke. He's going to come straight out and say, "Yep, this happened. I had the blue. I apologise. Dumb thing to do. All the best. Move on." You know, there would have been some CEOs who would have said to me, "Mate, buy that at all costs.
Bury it.
Don't care what you pay. Bury it. It's gone. Right, and then we'll worry about it later." But that doesn't, you know, this is a great lesson. It's not Ginge. It's a great lesson in life. So, you know, we even joked. I said, mate, in parts of the video, you look pretty shit ass. You know, James is on top of you and you're not, you know.
Punch the shit
out of
you.
It's not going that well. Yeah. You know, some of the stills.
There's only so much editing.
Well, that's right. You know, and Ginge loved it because some of the shots that he had, he had his arms raised like in this sort of
samurai.
Bruce Lee, samurai, Jackie Chan. He was actually just trying to keep the sun out of his eyes, but he looked like Bruce Lee, you know what I mean? So a couple of those shots they used in the paper were nice. But look, at the end of the day, we had that meeting. I went back into my office. The paparazzi girl's sitting there thinking she's about to win $300,000 from us to buy all the vision.
And that was a crisis. That was a Nine crisis.
That was a Nine crisis.
Let's face it, that was a crisis. Yep. Your CEO.
Yeah.
You know, effectively in a punch-up. At best, it's a fray.
Yeah.
You know, like fighting, or at worst, it could be something else. And to a large extent, reputationally, it's important for the Nine Network to make sure it doesn't get out. So to some extent, you have to control it. I mean, you have to control it by getting on the front foot.
That's right.
But
the consensus was that this ain't going to go away. If we bury it, they're going to be on our hammer forever. So we walk back in. The girl's sitting there with a laptop with all the vision and everything. And I said, no, don't worry about it. Take it to Holt Street. Take it to News Corp. They'll buy it.
Yep.
And, the discussion was $250,000. They did. She went straight there. They bought it. We just sat back and wore it.
Because the outcome is pretty good. I mean, relatively speaking, nothing. I mean, we've all forgotten about it. It's more of a funny thing to talk about these days.
Yeah.
And there was very little collateral damage to Channel 9, I think.
That's right. And I mean, you know.
Apart from a PAPS point of view, coming to you guys first, knowing that, like, you know, that potentially.
Potentially the price could be higher.
Yeah.
That's right. I think they got the shock of their lives. I think the girl was, she thought I was joking when I came back in. She didn't take me seriously. Yeah, she was almost pulling the paperwork out after I said, don't worry about it.
Cash,
you know what
check,
I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, cash or check. So she really got the shock of her life. But I think that was a great corporate lesson for me, great life lesson. and
just be honest.
Know, just be honest.
Yeah.
Fess up.
What's it like at a TV network? Is anything out of bounds? Anything
off limits?
Off limits.
Like, no, not really. Yeah, I mean, yeah. What happens is a bloke in my situation, running that program, CEOs, senior management, they don't want to be in a position to ask you not to run stuff. Hmm. Okay, there's no editorial control, even in relation to advertisers. Like, there's a great misnomer with shows like A Current Affair that we do ads for people and that we look after certain businesses because the boss tells us to.
Like me. Right?
Like me. You.
But they don't.
The classic thing with YBA. That's right. I mean, that's a different thing because, you know, Nine obviously.
But Nile always declare the position with me.
We declare it.
But if I go and do something stupid, I'm going to be a part of the Current Affair no matter what. Mm. Same as Ginger.
Exactly,
I mean,
if
James Packer told me once. He said, "Mate, when I was in the Wizard days, don't ever think Current Affair will not come after you," because they come after me.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so that's a good question. When Packer was running the show, was there anything that was off? Did he ever come? He doesn't own the place anymore, so he probably speak freely. But did he ever say, "No, you can't do this"? Did Kerry or James ever?
Not that I'm aware. But
if they did, it wouldn't have happened, mate.
But that's before my time.
Yeah, right.
In many respects, you know, in terms of running the joint.
I remember when they went after him, though. I remember when they went after James. It was over Jody. I mean, I remember it. And, like, James actually said to me, "Mate," he says, "mine too." He owned, you know, PBL owned it then. Mm. No, it wasn't in the different sort of environment as it is today.
Because, like, News Corp, it's a very different story, right? Like, Rupert, you know, anything that...
It's all about what's going to rate on the night too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we have to be aware that, like, in those days with Today Tonight on air or whatever, Seven News, they're going to go nuts. And the Nine newsroom, for example, ran the Ginge Packer Blue. Hmm. Okay? But A Current Affair doesn't need to then turn up with it for another 7 minutes because we haven't got the vision and the stills. If we bought those, if we decided to buy them, we would have run them. You know what I mean?
You had to pay News Corp, though, right, to run? I mean, not ACCA, but, like, Channel 9 in general had to pay News Corp to run the photos and...
What I'm saying is the paparazzi then went to News Corp and did the deal with them.
Yeah, sure, but
they paid the $250.
Post that, do you end up paying... I mean, you pay a diluted...
Under fair dealing in that situation.
Okay,
once they've been published, you can, under fair dealing, you can then run that material.
Sure.
Elements thereof, you know what I mean?
So, growing up... All that experience, mate, you know, some of which is a lot of fun, some of which is very stressful. What are you now seeing in corporate Australia? Because that's really what I wanted to talk to you about today. I mean, I'm actually fascinated that you're now seeing corporate Australia tap you on the shoulder and say, "Grant, we need some help with something or other." Tell me what that is.
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's, I think interestingly, what I've got, a couple of people, you know, words got around about my sort of skill set, as it were, and having...
Let's not be too conservative here, mate.
Yeah.
Let's not say skill set as it were, mate, because I'm going to pull you up now.
Yeah.
You're a young bloke.
Yeah.
Your skill set is enormous and your experience is ridiculously enormous. So people are actually asking you because of who you are. Not because of your, as it were, mate. You've got a bloody great skill set. So let's not undersell yourself right now. I actually want to hear... What is corporate Australia trying to get from you?
The way I look at it is, in the corporate affairs world, in the public relations world, in the crisis management world, there's hundreds of operators around Australia selling themselves in this sort of industry. All right, either in house working as an in-house staff member, or they're working as contractors, right? And I think word's got around to the extent that, well, there's not too many of them who've charged people with murder, run the John Laws show, and run A Current Affair for donkey's years,
and you're doing crisis management every week,
and crisis management every week. You know, whether it be my own show or whether it be stuff within Nine or outside. So I've been sort of doing some, you know, sort of pro bono advice here and there. And, you know, clearly what they're looking for, as you alluded to early in the session, is they're looking for intelligence in terms of where their business is positioned. One thing I've got from my time at the helm of A Current Affair is an acute awareness of what makes the audience tick, what they like, what they don't like, what products they like, what companies they like, what companies they like seeing bashed, what companies they support. I've got all that awareness now because we get minute-by-minute ratings every morning. So we basically play a football game every night of the week, and then at 9 o'clock the next morning we get the score on the scoreboard. They pull the curtains back and away we go. And we get the minute-by-minute ratings. So the little graph goes up and down, up and down. It can tell you what went well and what went like a busted ass. And obviously you can then make a mental...
And around a million people every night?
A million people.
Yep. More or less. So you're doing a survey of a million people every night about the sorts of messages and topics and content that either tick the boxes,
correct,
or annoy people or excite people,
yep,
or that they're absolutely glued to their seat about. And
correct,
you take that now to corporates.
100%.
So corporate can say to you, listen, Grant, mate, we've got a bit of a problem coming up here. Our CEO fought the CEO of our competitor.
Yep.
We don't quite know how to manage this. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about? Because, yeah, I mean that old Gingell Packer thing actually is probably helpful for your brand.
Yeah, no question. But the thing is, yeah, I'm talking about the crisis management. I'm talking about how to deal with the situation. I mean, people think about A Current Affair. Some CEOs and corporate Australia would think of A Current Affair as, these are the blokes that can really ruin my day, right? So how do they approach something? How do they approach a story? What works for them? Why would they come after us? What can we do to combat what they're intending to do? I'll give you, just looking at some positives as well, not just negatives. Take Coles and Woolworths, for example. Now, we do the odd story on Coles and Woolworths, as do the news bulletins now, because everyone's looking at hip pocket. Now, a lot of punters would generally look at our show and say, oh, Coles, they must have done an advertising deal, right? And so A Current Affair is doing a 9-minute story tonight on Coles about their new distribution warehouse and how they're going to slash prices on 20 items across the board, right?
Mm.
Nothing could be further from the truth. Hand on heart, we, in that situation, have annoyed the Christ out of Coles, and we've harassed their media people for 3 weeks to get that story up. Nothing to do with the sales department, nothing to do with advertising, right? The reason we've done that is because that story will rate and people want to know what discounts they can get on 30 or 40 items at Coles, and they want to see behind the scenes of where their groceries and their fruit and veggies come from. That's a positive for Coles. So we almost have to bring them, we have to bring them to the barrier, kicking and screaming, and then deliver them a 9-minute product, and they look at the story afterwards and say, We should have been hassling A Current Affair for a month to get that story done, but it was the other way around. People can't believe that, but that's just part of the insight into how the show's put together every day. We're after something that's going to rate, that's something that's good news. People would rather know where they can get cheap bananas than where to find a rotten banana. That's the truth of it, right? It's not all negative. You know, we're not out there every day saying, let's go and jam a Coles because they've got some shit grapes in their fruit and veggie section. Right? We'd rather, you know, and I'll give you a very crude example. A lot of our punters historically would love to go to Paddy's Markets and buy fake DVDs from some young fella down at Paddy's or Parkley Markets and buy fake DVDs. The last thing they want to see on A Current Affair is the police raiding this poor bastard, right, and locking him up and driving his Hiace away full of DVDs, right? That's a crude example of what I'm getting at, you know? It's not all negative.
Mm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not all negative. You've got to look at the messages that can get out there and how people want to operate their businesses. And I'm trying to cut through with a lot of these corporates as well, and thinking, well, hang on, I've got a lot of information that can really help them and guide them as to the way they operate their businesses day to day and the mindsets they have.
Would you call it public relations? Give me a couple of words.
I think it's brand enhancement. Yeah. It's brand protection. It's almost brand guidance. Mm. You know what I mean?
I like guidance. Yeah.
Guidance.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not suggesting I'm the...
Or even coaching, brand coaching.
Brand coaching. I'm not suggesting I'm the first bloke to think of this, but what I'm saying is if there's hundreds of other blokes out there and women in the marketplace doing it, then surely I've got something to offer in terms of the
So how do you gather all that information? So obviously, that IP is acquired through your work at Nine.
Yeah,
Backer.
That's right.
Like, how do you stay on trend? You get like a million young producers out there, just the finger on the pulse.
That's right. Well, what we do? It's not like that. It's basically because I've got a situation where I'm looking daily at the ratings performance of the program.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking at the historical. One thing about when you've had a couple of years of reasonable. Ratings, reasonable success in the role, it's very hard to step back. It's very hard for management to say, I'll rip this bloke out of here and give him something else to do. Because they know, the management know, that you've accumulated this knowledge along the way. You know what works, you know what doesn't work. You've got a really good sense of the place. And one thing about a current affair each night, it's almost like being the head programmer at the network on a micro scale. Because the head programmer at the network is plonking his shows, right, one by one, trying to work out where to put them, where to fit them, which ones will work, which ones won't, which one he'll put last, which one he'll put first. That's what we're doing every night with a half hour of television. And our job is crucial because we set up the night's viewing on the network. If a current affair doesn't work at 7 o'clock, then the rest of the evening is pretty well buggered. You know what I mean? It's a crucial, high pressure role because you've got that. You need that carry through.
Yeah, it leads in.
And you know, this time of year in particular, I mean, few people would realise that. You know, we outrate the news. We outrate the 6 p.m. news on a current affair. We had a recent run in 3 weeks ago where a current affair beat the 6 p.m. news something like nine nights in a 3 week period. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a great tick for the program that's been around for 40 years.
40 years?
Yeah. Yeah, in various guises, yeah. You know, either be, you know, with Willisie, Mike Willisie, et cetera. But it's pretty well been around since the early 70s, yeah.
Amazing.
You know, back to the Paul Hogan days and so on. And yeah.
Because I am getting old. I remember it. I do remember it. Grant, it's been fantastic to get you in there. Like, I think that for our listeners to have an opportunity to hear someone speak from the, not only from the grindstone, but someone who sort of sees the rawness of what goes on in this country in terms of, what you want to call a current affairs, but just the sort of stuff that you guys produce day in, day out for, you say, 40 years, in your case, probably the last 10 years, 8 years?
Yeah, well, I've been the national boss, certainly, for coming up to my eighth year.
And it's a great opportunity for people to hear sort of the rawness of what you do. I mean, I could talk to you for hours. We have someone else to talk to. But what I think is critically interesting for me is the emergence of, and the importance of the emergence of, corporate Australia starting to realise, well, wait a minute, we do need to have some brand coaching. We do need to get our brand managed more properly than they ordinarily would do with just PR people.
And by the public,
yeah,
not
right.
by...
Yeah.
And you being the proxy for the public, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. The proxy for the public.
A proxy for the public.
Yeah, that's good, Nick. Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it. He's a proxy for what people actually are thinking about various content and messages out there in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I wish I could use you in my business. I can't because I guess we're conflicted somehow, one way or the other, I guess.
Yeah.
But I think other organisations, I think Australian businesses need to start to think about this stuff a lot more closely than just, as opposed to just employing some international public relations firm. I'm not having a crack at the public relations firms, they're good. But when it comes to crisis management or getting a brand message out there, you really got to get to the ground to find it really at you've got to get the intelligence, I mean in terms of a policing concept, the intelligence of what people really, really think, not just focus groups.
Yeah, I think it's all about street smarts, Mark, you know, and I'm not trying to pump my tyres up, but at the end of the day, it's a question of where you get your information from. And you can have a PR person that's never worked a day as a journalist or a day as a copper, and they come in, they're straight out of uni, they've done a PR course, and if you can employ them and rely on them for all your guidance, and I wish you all the best with that, you know what I mean? But I'm seeing that, you know, a couple of people are tapping me on the shoulder. So there's obviously going to be a recognition. There must be a recognition out there that there's better ways to do things and there's better people to speak to. And I'm just grateful for you giving me the opportunity to come in and have a chat about it.
Mate, it's awesome. I'm glad you use fantastic content for us. So thanks, Grunner.
Good on you, mate. Thanks, mate.
So we've got Amber and Grant here from Creators Academy. Amber was desperately trying to get an Uber pitch on last month.
whenever the, I think it was the 29th that we did it. And, you know, as I was saying before, we had over 5,000 pitch requests. So, unfortunately, a few people missed out.
But yeah, about 4,950 or something.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess thanks to Amber's presence in social media, the comms team at Uber were able to pick her up and refer her on to us. And now we've got her here on the Mark Boorer Show pitching live, which is probably just as good as, right, Dad?
I think it's probably more nerve-wracking pitching live, but anyway.
Go for it.
So I'm Amber and I am one of Australia's leading celebrity stylists, and I'm here to seek your help to disrupt the education industry, so take a slice of the $100 billion e-learning industry. So my platform, the Creators Academy, is my e-learning platform that allows leading industry influencers to share their real-world business insights with people who need to quickly learn new skills to adapt to rapidly changing business models.
So look, based on the work we've done to date, the traditional education market is fit for disruption. You know, it's a model that sort of hasn't caught up with the current sort of new, faster business environment. You know, they're currently offering courses that's sort of one size fits all. It's still that sort of death by whiteboard presentation mentality. They're not really using new technologies as well as they could be. The content's not meeting industry needs, so we've done a lot of work with colleges and TAFEs and other learning institutions, and they're really screaming out for sort of industry hands-on skills, but a lot of their courses are still being put together by lecturers and educators who don't have that skill set. And I guess it's for, you know, people are changing careers a lot sooner these days. It's every sort of 3 to 5 years people are switching up their careers. So they need to be able to access education that's faster, that's more on point, and that's meeting those new faster business models.
So the new student wants to be able to self-select the skills that they need for the career that they want. They want to learn anywhere, anytime. They don't want to have to go to a classroom and be at a certain place at a time each week. They want to quickly gain the skills to change careers or move up the ladder and upskill quickly for rapidly changing business needs, and also learn from the people who have actually done it, so people who have achieved what they want to achieve, and learn specific industry skills without needing to mortgage the house. So the Creators Academy is an online training program. It's available to anyone, anywhere globally. It's taught by business leaders who have achieved significant industry status. And I guess that's probably the most biggest significance between us and the traditional model of education. It's practical, real-world knowledge that's directly relevant to situations that you're exposed to and on the job. I believe it's the next stage of influencer marketing, and it's a completely scalable business model that provides leverage income. And we also have the ability to pivot quickly to any new and emerging markets.
So the e-learning industry is currently worth almost $100 billion. So it's doubled in size from 2011 to 2013.
Globally? Yeah.
Yep, globally. And it's doubled again in the last couple of years. So we're in sort of a really rapidly growing marketplace.
Yeah. So just to know that I have been testing and putting this to market for the last 12 months. I have 3 stylist training programs. As one of Australia's leading celebrity stylists, I now teach people how to do what I do. And it's the real world stuff that you face when you're trying to set yourself up as a stylist and what you're actually doing on a photo shoot, working with celebrities, being a fashion editor of a magazine. At the moment, I've got affiliate packages with colleges globally, so they're out there selling my programs for me.
Stylist program?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And the results are pretty good. I've got about 560 students around the globe from Australia, the UK, USA, as well as really random places like Ghana and Malaysia. And I have an average conversion rate of about 8%, whereas the industry average for the internet marketers and e-courses is about 2 to 3%. So I'm performing well above industry average. It's just a behind the scenes of what it looks like in one of my programs and some testimonials from my students. You know, I get really raving testimonials, 5 stars. Everyone thinks it's, you know, really hands-on practical knowledge that they haven't learnt in courses that they've already studied in, you know, the fashion industry.
Yeah, so a lot of the people that have done the course so far have actually studied somewhere or are studying somewhere, but they're actually not getting the sort of hands-on, real-world experience that they're after, and so that's why they're joining this kind of course.
Can I just interject? If I'm taking your course, what does that consist of? What does it entail? Like,
yeah, so they're video modules and downloadable templates. So you log into my platform and then you it's self-paced learning. So you can just log in and do the courses at your own speed, and then you get a certificate at the end.
Okay. Yeah. And how long does it take?
It depends. You know, I have
how
some
hard people, I go at it. I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So you can complete an entire course over a weekend, but then I find people that have, you know, do it over a 3-month period.
Cost of the course?
One course is $300, 3 courses are $1,000.
Right. Yeah. And do you get a, like a certificate for or something like that?
We're not nationally accredited because you have to you know, follow certain criteria to get that accreditation, which is not actually what you need on the real world, like in the real world. So that's why we're not going down that train, like the nationally accredited path, but you do get a certificate of completion, like an industry recognized certificate.
So I do your course,
yep.
$300 or whatever it costs, and I go along to Granta at Channel 9 and I say, oh, can I get a job in your stylist department?
Yep.
Because they got one. Well, they've sort of got one.
Yeah, yeah, they do.
What do you think so? We're going
to
grunt.
Yeah, I don't have access to it. I don't know if you worked that out.
behind the camera.
Would I get a job? Would I be able to get a job there, or how does it work?
I can teach you how to get
a freelancer, or how's it work?
Yeah, that's right. So in my training programs, I teach you how to approach someone like Grant to get a job. So what sort of follow you're going to need, how to approach them for an internship, all those sorts of
and
things.
And doing your course, do I get the skills to do it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I mean, the skills, not just to approach them, but the skills.
No, that's right. So
what is a stylist? Tell me what it is.
A stylist is someone who, you know, dresses people for a living, I guess. So I teach you how to, you know, source the products, what colours suits what sort of people, what shapes suit what sort of people, all those sorts of things.
It's not makeup or anything?
No, it's fashion.
Fashion, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so pardon my ignorance.
Have you considered that a course like that, whilst aimed at the specifics of being an industry celebrity stylist, sounds to me like it's the perfect course for a 22-year-old girl from sports school to do, to be able to sell product and to be smart about how she goes about retail.
Yeah, exactly.
What about people just are conscious about their image, you know, and looking good, right?
That's actually a course that I've got in development at the moment. So I've got two courses that are going to be pitched to people that want to dress themselves. But this is sort of separate to the Creators Academy. But it's in development.
The other thing is it's for people that want to start their own business as well. So it's providing all of those skills that Amber's learnt over the last 5 years, or that any influencer's learnt over their lifetime, to enable someone to quickly start a business. So getting straight to the point of, you know, startup.
So, by the way, you just said something very interesting, Grant. Influencers. Please tell me tell our audience what you mean by influencers and why are you an influencer? Either one of you.
Oh, I mean, I guess an influencer is someone who has succeeded in their chosen industry and who now has sort of influence over the market within that industry. So,
via social?
Yeah, via social, yeah. So I communicate to an audience of about 70,000 people on a daily basis across my blog, social and YouTube channels.
Right.
And that's been built up over, you know, the last 5 years or so.
How did you build it up, Amber? Can you tell me, because there's a lot of people. How old are you?
30-ish.
Okay, you're a kid, right? Young person. And a lot of people in your age group are thinking, God, I'd love to have 70,000 people follow me on Instagram or wherever it is, Twitter, I don't know what media you use. How do you build that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is a lot of analytics behind it. I'm a civil engineer by trade, so I'm really interested in data and how things are put together. So Instagram is my biggest following, so I've done extensive online training programs as to how to succeed in Instagram. There's a whole lot of data and analytics that you can look at on the back end about what time to post, when to post, which hashtags to use, which content gets the most likes, which content gets the most shares, all that sort of thing.
And did you build some sort of algorithm out of all this? I mean, did you actually sit down and say,
algorithms out there.
Yeah,
but that's actually a great opportunity for a course. And so one of the courses that we want to do is how to succeed in Instagram, how to succeed in YouTube, those sorts of things, which is what people actually want to know.
What do you think the big point of difference is between you with, you know, 70,000 people in your network and someone only has, I don't know, 5,000, and, you know, I as a layperson can't tell the difference? Like, you know, you're all quite glamorous people and you know, wearing good stuff and you're looking good and all the rest of it. But, like, what's the difference, the discerning factor that separates someone from 5,000 to 70,000?
I think if you look at feeds, if you pull up a feed of someone with 5,000 and the feed of someone with 70,000, there is a significant difference. So all of my photos are professionally taken photos. Like, they're not just, you know, me having a selfie and it's grainy and out of focus. Like, they're really professional photos.
So you have someone following you around? Like,
I have a camera and a tripod. It's painfully. Right. Yeah, painful. Yep. Yeah. And we'll get one today, don't worry.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, okay, I've been told I'm a bit of a, I can be cynical about things, and sometimes some people have said to me, you can buy followers. I mean, is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. But then you can tell that there's no engagement and no influence over that market, so it's really no point in doing it.
Yeah, a person with 5,000 followers could have much more engagement than a person with 70,000, so they're more valuable.
So when you become an influencer, is it about the engagement you have with the number of people you have, or is it engagement, or is it more about numbers?
I believe it's more about engagement. I don't think the industry is quite there yet. I think the industry is looking purely at numbers, but I definitely think that's the way it's going. You know, people are going to start looking at, well, where is your influence? Is it in Australia or is it internationally? You know, when you posted a posted a photo, how much you know engagement did you get? What was the buy through? Those sorts of things. I think that's where the industry is going to go.
So you're going to run a course in your program for people to go and set up, you know, social accounts and how to actually optimize it.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So there's one that can happen for sure.
But let's say some 25-year-old girl or boy is following your programs and they go into they find this module in your education program. Why would they want to do that? What is it just because they want to establish themselves in a stylish way, or they want to establish themselves for a social way, or are they trying to run a business, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the majority of my student, well, all of my students want to set up a styling business, so they want to know how to have a successful styling business, and a lot of my social drives offline jobs. So like, you know, people will see my social media and go, oh, can I book you as a stylist? And so that's really the main way to drive business these days.
And celebrity stylist, did you mean you're promoting to how you dress yourself as a celebrity, style yourself as a celebrity, or you're saying to people, or are you saying celebrities come to me for styling advice? Which one is
correct?
It?
Yeah, so the latter. One. Yeah, so I dress a lot of celebrities and it's just the finishing touches of like, you know, how do I show my celebrity the dresses? In what order do I put the dresses on? So it's all these kind of little things that you don't really know until you've been doing it for a really long time.
How'd you get from civil engineering to this?
Yeah.
Yeah, hang on. You're trying to blow me out of the water with a career change here, aren't you? Yeah.
What about yours, Grunter? Like cop to bloody Acker.
Yeah, that's right. I've still got the Lowe's suits though, you know what I mean?
They were free.
This has been one long, like, 20-year sting operation on Channel 9, hasn't
right.
it?
Exactly right.
How'd you get from civil engineering?
Yeah, I mean, I used to work on a construction site building roads and bridges for Leighton Contractors, and I used to build my paint my steel cap boots pink. My nickname was Pinky, so I was in the thick of it, and it was a great, you know, it was great fun. But fashion was always my passion, so I started a fashion label, me on a sewing machine. I made 4 shirts the first week and sold them the first week, and then made 8 shirts the next week and sold them the next week. 5 years later, my brother and I had 120 accounts around Australia.
Oh, your grand's your brother?
Yep.
Okay, cool.
Couldn't tell?
Yeah, I can. Now you say it.
We exported to Paris, Tokyo, LA and South Africa. We dressed some of the biggest celebrities of our time, which back in the day was Paris Hilton, and it used to be cool to dress Paris Hilton. And we did runway parades all around the world. So I was doing the design and manufacturing. Grant does all branding and comms.
Right, okay. So you, it's like a family business.
Yeah, it always is.
And where's the business at now? Like, what stage are you guys at?
The label, we ended that in 2007.
Oh, sorry, your current business? Like, are you guys looking for capital? Or yeah, I mean, what's the next step, I guess?
Yeah, that's right. So the next step is building the platform and engaging other content creators to come aboard. So what I'm really strong at and what I've been doing for the last 18 months is like my master's in internet marketing. So I've been learning how to create, market and grow an e-course. So, you know, what's the perfect module count in your creation, how to communicate to visual versus auditory versus kinesthetic learners. So really understanding that. And then also how to launch a course. So, you know, I launched my courses about a year ago and I was like, oh, I've got a course, and no one bought the course, you know. So it was, I've been like 12 months trying to figure out how to actually market a course and how to get interested students to buy that course.
Are you marketing the course?
All through social, so Facebook, Instagram and Google remarketing.
So a lot of your course participants would come off your social follower?
Correct. Yeah.
But also working with affiliates and other partners to drive the courses through their networks as
well. So like Uber, for example?
More so like fashion colleges. So like, you know, traditional fashion colleges that don't have a styling program. So I'm speaking with them and they're selling my styling program to their existing students, their existing database.
What's sort of cool about this is it is disruptive in terms, you're right, Grant, it's the education industry is like so slow. So you're not going to go and do a course at TAFE. I don't even have a course in TAFE for this stuff, but you're not going to sit in TAFE for 6 months, cost you $1,000, whatever it is, and you turn up to a lecture, and if you don't get up to the lecture, you miss the lecture.
That's right.
Yep. Then you're behind, then you're stressed, and you think, what the hell am I doing this for? This is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can pick it up. You can do it again. You can lifetime access. I guess it's priced accordingly because it's internet-based, so you don't have to pay someone to be in a rented premises, you know, at 7 p.m. on a Thursday evening when you're paying them overtime, I guess. So that makes that sort of stuff's pretty intelligent and pretty smart. It's the way things are done today. The demand for styling, tell me about that. Is there a demand to be styled or to understand styling today?
Yeah, absolutely. So according to Facebook ads, and, you know, because you can target an ad to someone who's got an interest in stylist or who has a job title as a stylist, there's 2.1 million people around the world that want to do it. So even if 1% of them buy a course, then that's a pretty handy kind of business.
Yeah, so and sorry, where'd you get the 2.1?
So on Facebook ads, you can sort of target your Facebook ads to anyone who has an interest in as a job as a stylist or anyone who wants to be a stylist. So
globally.
Yeah, globally. And Facebook sort of...
So who's your competitor?
So there are two main competitors in the market. So, first one is Mastered. They launched in January 2014. They're based in the UK. They offer a really time-specific course, so you have to log in at a certain time to do that specific course. And it's really industry-heavy, hands-on. So they've got heaps of great opportunities within the industry, which is great. The programs are taught by British icons, so like Nick Knight, Sam McKnight. They're big in the UK, I'm sure, but I've been in this industry for 12 years and I've never heard of them here in Australia. So shows that there's opportunity for us to do one here. Their photography course waitlist has 12,000 people on the waitlist. It says so on their website. If you assume that only 3% of them convert, that's about a $900,000 course, because their course is valued at $2,500, which I think is a bit above.
Is that a course about how to photograph yourself?
Not yourself. But so like if you want to be a photographer,
right, okay.
Yeah, so how to shoot for magazines, shoot advertising campaigns, that sort of thing. So, and they're fashion industry based. The American version launched in May 2015 and they have evergreen courses that, which are really
interesting. What's that called?
Masterclass.
It looks like Scott Camp.
It's Dustin Hoffman.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's like Scott Camp. Has he got Dustin Hoffman's
Dustin Hoffman is...
Is that his business or his front?
No, he's teaching a class.
Right.
Yeah.
So in our model, he'd be an influencer.
That's right.
So, wow, Dustin Hoffman's teaching a class
and
on...
And Serena Williams is teaching a class on tennis. Usher is teaching a class on performance.
I'm just sort of extrapolating out the growth plan for you guys. So is the idea to sort of get as many influencers on there teaching their craft as possible?
Yeah.
Like, and I guess is there an incentive for these guys?
To,
I mean, like, because a lot of them make good money just flogging product. You know what I mean? They don't really have a huge incentive to go and create a program of their own and teach essentially competitors how to take market share off themselves, right? I mean, how are you going to drive people to build programs and to be part of your platform with you?
Essentially the model that we're looking at is a profit share model. So working with influencers and them getting a cut of actually what they create.
Mm.
So our role in that will be actually facilitating them getting onto our platform. So helping them figure out the content that they want to be teaching, put it into a plan that's actually going to work for students, and then work on a profit share model with them. So that's sort of how we're...
Partnering up.
Yeah. Partnering up.
So are you chasing the influencers and or are you waiting for them to come to you?
We will be chasing them.
Yeah. So you're going to go chase an influencer and say to this, you know, someone who's an influencer, listen, we want you to come in onto our program, partner up with us. We're going to promote you and your course.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And do you do the course content or how's it all work? Does the influencer have to build that or?
We'll guide them. We'll mentor them through the process. I think that's the biggest barrier to entry. I think someone like yourself might be interested in teaching people, but how do you actually get a course together? How do you put a course online? How do you market a course? Like, I think that's the barrier to entry for a lot of people, whereas I'm sure people like you, Grant, would love to give your information away and help other people come up, but it's difficult to actually get that information out of your head and onto a platform that people can go and easily purchase.
And you would do that part?
I do that part. Yeah, that's right.
Right, so you would sit down and you'd sort of trudge through that sort of process and build it up.
Yep.
You've got a model that you build this
Correct.
Into.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're just filling the fields out.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
So we're going to start with the fields that we know. So it's in the fashion, photography, styling, those kind of fields, and then we hope to broaden out to more.
I'm curious. How do you teach? How does a lifestyle grammar or blogger teach their course? is there actually a formula to that? You think?
Well, as I said, with Instagram, there's a formula to being successful on Instagram, and people don't know that. You know, they think it's just taking a selfie and waking up Insta famous. You know, but there's process that goes into it behind the scenes. So, how do you know that stuff?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Very clever. Very good. I mean, new world, mate.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I have to say, what strikes me straight away, though, is that niche targeting of someone like a celebrity stylist. You know, my brain immediately goes to broader audience, okay? And I'm thinking immediately of how many kids are working in Chadstone Shopping Centre in Melbourne, or how many kids are at Westfield Centrepoint, right, coming out of school or out of uni or whatever and working for fashion houses or even retail chains, like I mentioned, Sports Girl and businesses like that. I think there's great application for the styling course in that sort of realm.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, everyone thinking they're going to be able to get a job at the Nine Network when they've done a $300 styling course. But I think the broader application is for something like retail.
Even if it's just how they carry themselves and how they present themselves. I mean, I mean, if I'm employing somebody, not necessarily in your industry, but if I'm employing somebody, I'm actually interested to know, do they have followers on Instagram? Do they know how to do the social media stuff? How do they present themselves to me? How have they presented themselves to the public in their Instagram or Facebook or wherever it is?
Yeah.
And that's sort of, that's a new wave, a new world coming through. You guys have picked it.
That's something that I remember when I was at Kaplan Markets, we go do those Kaplan compliance online courses every couple of months. I mean, yeah, there is room for like a retail. Why don't retailers are doing that for their employees? They're saying, listen, you guys are selling fashion and this product. We need to skill you up a bit more and make sure that that you're on point when you're selling us.
That's right. I mean, how does the manageress, keep coming back to Sports Girl, but doesn't matter what, how does the manageress at Centrepoint, when she's interviewing 14 kids out who've responded to a Seek.com ad, how does she decide, having a sit down with 12 or 14 of those guys, who she's going to go for? Well, if a kid turns up and says, look, I've got off my ass and I've done this course and I'm now a styling guru, that's a good start.
And I've got people following me.
Yeah.
And look, here's an example of what I do.
Yep.
This is the quality of what I do.
Yeah.
And
I don't think it's about the credentials. It's not even about the credentials. It's just about being better at your job.
Yeah, having someone else.
That's right.
Like just learning what you need to know.
That's right, rather than the stuff that they teach you at TAFE, which is not what you need to know.
Mm.
Typically, in my industry.
No. Brilliant. Great outcome. Thanks very much. I'm glad you persisted through Uber to come in and pitch to us today.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Well done, guys.
Well, that was really interesting, Nick. Grunter telling us about old school journalism and, you know, old school coppers and how he's taking that to the market now. And then completely diametrically opposed to that is, let's call it modern, young school brand building and young school promotion and young school education taking on the education system. That was quite interesting to see how they interacted and how totally different they were, but both totally relevant. Mate, what are we doing for next week?
So next week we've got the Minister for Innovation, Wyatt Roy, coming in.
I'm looking forward to talking to Wyatt.
And, we've been chatting about, change in government for the last few months now and with the new Malcolm Turnbull government and Wyatt Roy as a Minister for Innovation, hopefully there's some good chat to come off the back of that one.
My mate David Coleman, who's a parliamentarian now, used to be on the board of Yellowbrick Road, gives a guy I really respect in terms of digital stuff, gives Wyatt Roy an extraordinary rap, and everybody I talk to says great things about Wyatt Roy. So,
he's young as well, and I think he understands the plight of young entrepreneurs and SMEs and startups, and the challenges that are ahead of them, and what we need to do to overcome those barriers.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to him, and he's probably slightly the opposite to Bruce Bilson, who was the Minister for Small Business. We now got a Minister for Innovation.
Yeah.
That's a big call by the Turnbull government.
Yep.
Looking forward to talking to him. And by the way, he comes from, I think his local area is Moreton Bay, Wyatt Roy. That's his sort of environment where he's a local elected parliamentarian. And I spoke up there a couple of weeks ago to an event, and everybody's so excited about having Wyatt Roy as their guy. And so
they've touted him as the next prime minister if he can hang out and he doesn't have any skeletons in the closet. And
he's probably too young to have skeletons.
Yeah.
So look forward to talking to him, and have a good weekend, guys.
Cool.
This has been the Mark Boris Podcast. You can follow Mark on Twitter @MarkBoris and find out more at markboris.com.au.